Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the seventh Norwegian Biometric Laboratory workshop. My name is Nils Kalstad Svensen, and I'm the department head of the Department of Information Security and Communication Technology in NTNU. We are very proud to have the longest department name in the new NTNU, and we are also very proud to be one of the departments which has large activity in both Trondheim campus and in Gjøvik campus. One of the larger groups and longest-lasting groups in our department is the Norwegian Biometrics Laboratory, who's for many years been standing out and doing significant research contribution in addition to their contribution to their study programs or in the study programs of NTNU. And this is also one of the reasons why this event has been going on for so long, and it seems to have established a stable community of attendances. So I strongly welcome both the new who are here for the first time and those who are here for a recurring times. I also want to thank the organizing committee, and in particular Kiran, who's been doing a lot of hard work for this year's event. And I think before we start, even we can give him a little hands up. And also to the contributors who are giving talks during the day. And we are looking forward to a very interesting set of discussions around the smartphone-based biometrics, which is a very current and relevant theme in so many ways, I would say, both technically, organizatorically, legally, and so forth. And we see ongoing processes with this at all levels in the society in Norway today. And as an example of this was the recent open hearing on the adjustment of the law on how one can access or emphasize pressure to access phones with biometric data. And in this context, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you all, and I wish you a good day with very nice discussions. And I leave the floor to Christoph.
Now working? Now it is working. Yeah. Thank you, Nils, for the work. Thank you, Kiran, for organizing this event. My name is Christoph Busch. I'm chairing the Norwegian Biometric Laboratory, and so I would like to introduce a little bit about our work. Before I do so, a remark. You have received an envelope at the entrance. This envelope contains a bit of interesting reading material, the agenda that's relevant, a link where you can download the slides, and then one paper that I would like to highlight. This is the paper that is preparing our panel discussion this afternoon, and the intention is that during the day we collect questions, and these questions will be discussed then at the end of the day. Good. In a few slides, I would like to present what the Norwegian Biometric Laboratory is about. It's about biometrics. It was introduced, as Nils said, some years back. At that time, we were a little college, Gjøvik University College. We have merged with NTNU, or we have been integrated into NTNU just last year. As before, we are still a focus point, we can say, in our department, focusing on biometric research and activities. So we assemble a number of faculty members and PhD students and postdocs, and very proud. When we started with this organization, NBL 2011, it was a small group. We became a bit larger, more projects coming in. And 2 years ago, that was the group picture. Now, what is remarkable is now this group picture from this year. You see all the names that are now members of NBL, you see a few key factors. And if you look at this group picture, there are a few things that are notable and somehow express the evolution of our group. And I'm not referring to the fact that maybe the group members don't look so serious anymore. We still do serious research, so that's not the point. No, I think the other issues that are notable here is, number one, NTNU is dominating our work, so that's visible. Number two, we turn a little bit gray, and I'm not referring to the hair color, I'm referring to the clothes, so that is corporate identity. But it's also a proof that soft biometrics based on clothes recognition doesn't work always. And then the other fact that is visible here, and well, actually it's not visible, is that we are so busy that many of our group members are always on travel, and it was very hard to find a day with a large group being on campus. So if you count the faces on this picture and count the number of people listed here, you see a mismatch, and this is due to the fact that even this week there are project meetings where group members are attending. Yeah, a few topics that we do work on, physiological and behavioral biometrics is, of course, in scope of our work. We have a special interest in privacy-enhancing technology. We also look at presentation attack detections. And the number of projects that we have conducted is illustrated here. What is grayed out is already completed, and there are a few projects that we are currently working on. Just to give you a bit of a taste, what we do whenever we have a practical problem, for instance, not being able to access RAIN images from vendors of commercial devices, we are creative and we build our own device. So that is the famous Ragu blue box that is here on the lower left, illustrated with the images, and the lady here on the right, for the non-Norwegians, that's our prime minister, Mrs. Solberg, and she visited our lab and the famous blue box some time ago. So that was work in our European project Fidelity. It was also dealing with indexing methods, RAIN recognition, as I mentioned, and biometric template protection. If you're interested in more details on this, we have a few posters in the hallway. We have the flyers that illustrate the content of the poster. So in the break, you can talk with the lab members, and now you know how you recognize a lab member, except Kieran, he's properly dressed. He's also a lab member, not having the hoodie today. Good, template protection, what is this about? You know that the new General Data Protection Regulation is coming into force. We have to comply, we all have to comply with that next year. And one of the issues that is discussed there is that biometric data is sensitive data, so you can only process that if you have proper safeguarding mechanisms in place and sensitive, for instance, illustrating medical information that is contained. And in order to protect that, we do biometric template protection. Another typical example where we show that our research is application-oriented is the need to express the quality of a biometric sample that we collect. And we have been working with a few German and US partners on a software kit that is named NFIQ, NIST Fingerprint Image Quality version 2, which is now being rolled out. And the idea of this is to take a fingerprint and then produce a score on the range of 0 for being bad and 100 for being fantastically good. And if the operator decides a threshold of 80 is required, then he can tell the individual, the data subject, whether he needs to recapture or he can go on. And then the last project that I want to present is the SWAN project, and that's somehow the stimulus for our workshop today. That's dealing with smartphone biometrics and with financial transactions, but we will hear more on that during the day. Yeah, if you like the event today, the good news is there is another event next year. We move from week 8 to week 9 to accommodate the Oslo vacation period. If you're very interested in biometrics, I would like to invite you for the BIOSIG conference that is taking place in September in Germany. Yeah, and if you want to contribute to this conference, there is a call for papers in your leaflet to consider that and submit your work to that conference. With that, I would like to thank you for being here. I'd like to thank Kiran for organizing the event, and I hand over the microphone to Kiran.
Thank you, Christoph, for the nice introduction of the biometrics laboratory. Today's topic of discussion would be smartphone-based biometrics, opportunities and challenges. I would like to welcome you for this event. And the main backdrop of the event is that we are talking about the evolution of smartphones in a larger context, starting from capturing simple pictures to the use in the extensive use of mobile banking or smartphone banking. Why this topic does gain importance is that we have the market which says the number of personal devices that are growing every year is increasing exponentially, more or less. As you can see, there are a total of 650 million mobile PCs that are expected to be in by 2020, which means that with so many devices coming into the market, there is a substantial amount of mobile devices that get used for authentication act. Which, as you can see in the figure, you can see that there are right now 7.1 billion mobile subscriptions, and it's expected to grow up to 9.5 billion mobile subscriptions by the year 2020. And as you can see from the right-hand side, the transactions that are taking place via mobile are increasing constantly, and it's expected to be around 4.9 billion by the end of 2019. And these are not just the market forecasts. These are actually happening in the real life. As you can see, many banks are embracing biometrics. They are embracing biometrics through the use of smartphones. And there are a couple of banks which are already started the pilot projects and are experimenting with the real world. And here are some of the examples where the different kind of modalities are being used. In the beginning, when Sajam Security introduced the fingerprint card, they were not very successful. And then in the second revolution, when Apple iPhone introduced the fingerprints for mobile transactions or mobile authentication, it became a popular mode. Following the trend, there were other major players who got into the game, and they started using different modes of biometrics. They used face or they used eyes, and recent success of US-based company iVerify has indicated that there is substantial growth in terms of biometrics. Coming to the opportunities, we discussed so many opportunities, but what are the other challenges that we have? The challenges are that we never have ideal data all the time. The data is always corrupted, or the data is always degraded, or the user is not cooperative. And that means that you have a number of challenges which result in such kind of degraded data. And then we also have other kind of problems like presentation attack, where the artifact samples are used and they are used to attack the systems. Sophisticated attacks, again, they contain different kind of innovative attacks which include print and the display attacks, so that the systems are really challenged. With these kind of challenges being involved, there are also other kind of challenges which at the base level involve the system security and the software security of the smartphone itself. So in order to accommodate all these different challenges and different opportunities, we have a number of speakers that are highly experts in the domain. And from starting, we have the talk on security aspects of smartphone biometrics by Dr. Rolf Lindemann, who is an expert IT expert in the Knock Knock Labs, followed by the talk on online signature verification, which is quite well established in the banking sector. And this is given by Professor Javier Ortega. And then we have a small coffee break, following which we'll have two more interesting discussions. And one of the other discussion would be a similar project like SWAN. It is a project sponsored by European Union, and it is also investigating on the aspects of mobile biometrics and smartphone biometrics. And then we have a talk from Professor Ross, who's going to talk on ocular biometrics. And then we have another talk from our own university. We have Martin speaking on privacy-preserving biometrics, such that all the data that we are capturing in the smartphone for banking applications are securely stored on these devices and securely communicated. When all these things are considered, of course, there is a bigger question of how usable or how friendly is the software itself to be used in the regular scenario. And in order to cover that aspects, we have Professor Luke talking on the usability aspects of smartphone biometrics. That would conclude most of the talks for this today. And then we have an interesting panel discussion that would be taking care of all the questions that has been raised during the entire session. And then there would also be a discussion on the cost action of the European Union. With that, I would like to welcome you all for the workshop. And then I would like to invite Dr. Ralph Lindemann to give a talk on security aspects of the smartphone biometrics. Please welcome Dr. Ralph Lindemann.
So good morning. My talk is about authentication security, especially with a focus on mobile devices. And so what we want to avoid is essentially the scenario you see on this nice cartoon over here. Right, so it's great that I can maneuver my car with that smartphone. Hopefully it's really my car. And let's look into the details, what that means. I want to start with the security aspect, really what are the numbers, what are the attacks we are seeing in the market right now. So one of the dominant attack patterns we are seeing in the internet today is the password stolen from servers. So I think there are interesting studies that more than 1 billion passwords have been stolen from different servers, which is a very bad attack, right? The user can't do anything about it. It's just attackers going after the server, and sooner or later they succeed in stealing the passwords. It's one interesting pattern. So whenever we want to introduce new authentication methods which are better, right, we have to make sure that we really can protect against those dominant attack vectors today. The second is also interesting, the phishing attacks. We have seen that a lot. And if you talk to the large internet players like the Googles, the PayPals and so on, they always say this is the dominant thing they are seeing these days in the internet. It's just people are going after this bearer token, the password, to convince the people to enter the password into an untrusted website, which creates other interesting questions, right? How can I as an end user understand whether the website is the original one, the legitimate, the trusted application, or the malicious website trying to phish my password? And then, of course, there's all these two-factor schemes we have introduced, the one-time passcodes over SMS, for example, or the OTP hardware tokens, and interesting attacks which we have seen in the wild, like Eurograbber, which are concerted attacks going after your PC to modify the transaction you are trying to authorize, and second, intercepting the OTP on your either the smartphone and sending it off to the attacker's website, or intersecting it while being entered on the PC again. So interesting attacks, and whenever we want to design new authentication systems, those are the baseline attacks we have to protect against. That doesn't mean there's nothing else. There will be new attacks, but that's the baseline we at least have to protect against. So some more, we have seen a lot of data breaches, and the number is constantly increasing. I think the Verizon deal with Yahoo was now bringing one to our attention, which is the Yahoo attacks. I think in total, it's more than 1 billion accounts just compromised from Yahoo's website. And the interesting aspect of this one, this particular one, is that we now can calculate the cost of a breached record. Right? We didn't do that or we couldn't do that in the past. We had the Poneman study on average cost per breach incident, but not per breach record. Now that the Verizon has announced they will drop the price by whatever, a couple of hundred million, $350 million and dollar, and now you can relate that to the number of breached records, you can calculate it's roughly about 23 cents, dollar cents, per breached record. Interesting number, just to understand what that really means. And the second number is, we know that 95% of all incidents we are seeing today, which are breaking web application security, are based on weak authentication in one or the other way. So authentication is a major issue. It's highly relevant, and it gets more relevant over time. So reason enough to work on that. How does it work? How do we authenticate today? Right. So if we want to authenticate to a remote server, there's some gap to bridge. And I would argue we don't have Wi-Fi interfaces in our head. So there's no way for us to do that without a local device. Right. There is no way for me to authenticate to a server in the US without having a local computer in my reach, which can record my voice, which can provide me a keyboard I can type into, which presents me a fingerprint sensor or whatever, right? But something which is local. So in the end, we have to split the authentication into two pieces. One is a local interaction, and the other is a remote thing. And there seems to be one very important piece in the middle. And now let's give it a name. Let's call it authenticator, and call the local action we have between the authenticator and the user user verification, because this is not the remote authentication to the server. This is just the first piece of that thing. And the second, it's some authentication protocol. And now we essentially divide the authentication into different things, right? One is a local interaction between me and some authenticator, and the other is some authentication protocol running between that authenticator and the server. And now let's remind us ourselves with how it works with a password. The local verification is I enter the password into, hopefully, the authenticator, and the authenticator does nothing else than just sending the password off to the server, right? So it's a very trivial authenticator in that sense, and it also makes clear why this password scheme is so vulnerable to a lot of attacks. Now, if you want to make it better, let's assume we can come up with some standardized authentication protocol, which is not dependent on whatever we do on the front end, so which we can decouple from the user verification method. And let's introduce all the concepts we have learned in the last 30 years in cryptography, essentially meaning, so what is the best cryptographic method? So first, it's using asymmetric keys to make sure that whatever you can steal from the server does not allow you to impersonate the user. What we have obviously not achieved is the passwords, right? Even though the passwords may be encrypted or hashed, right? If you steal the password, there are still the rainbow tables, and somehow there's a way for the attackers to recompute the original password, get from there. Now, assume we run a cryptographic challenge response protocol. We have a public key stored on the server side. We have some secret key stored in the authenticator, which the authenticator needs to protect, and then we use just the user verification method in the front end to unlock that key to do some standardized cryptographic protocol. And with that approach, we gain some kind of scalability, or two different dimensions of scalability. The first dimension is we can support arbitrary modalities, right? Whether this is a pin-based verification or a fingerprint or some other biometrics, the server doesn't care, right? The server wants to know that for other reasons, and we will come to that. But from a technical implementation perspective, there's no need for the server to understand what modality the authenticator is really using, which is great, because in the internet there's so much diversity we have today. There's no way that a single server would support all the different modalities which are preferred by different people in different regions of the world. And the second dimension of scalability is the implementation choices we can make when implementing the authenticator, or the protection measures we have to apply to make sure that the cryptography is the right cryptography, that the implementation of the cryptography is somehow secure, that the integration with the user verification method is secured against various attacks. And we will come to that. But with that scalability, there's also the question which the server typically has, which is, so how could I know what security characteristics the authenticator on the other end of the internet has? which is an important question. And so we need to introduce some kind of method, which I would like to call attestation, right? Which gives a cryptographic proof to the server side, which allows the server to understand what kind of authenticator model it really is. And then from there, the server can have a table to look up what that model means, right? Whether this is the authenticator, for example, implemented in the Galaxy S6 phone, or whether this is some external USB token with a fingerprint sensor on it, or things like that, right? So some attestation that the server knows what kind of authenticator it is, what the security characteristic is, and from there derive the trustworthiness, the risk score, if you will, on the server side. So this is something I omitted a bit, right? There's always, authentication is always a two-step thing, right? It's an explicit signal presented by some front-end system, hopefully the authenticator, and there's some explicit implicit risk calculation in the back-end, which the server performs, which takes into account all the other things we have, right? Round-trip times, GeoIP, transaction volumes, and so on, just to make sure we understand what we want to achieve and what the resulting risk might be. Now, the next interesting aspect is, now, I, as a user, also have some kind of expectations and privacy expectation, and we had discussions around that in the past. Would I, for example, to enter any unknown door, would I present my eye or put my eye into a iris scanning facility where I don't know as a user whether this is a laser trying to destroy my eye or is it just an iris scanner? And there are kind of issues, and this depends a bit on the region in the world where you are, what kind of expectations users have, how much trust they have into an unknown device. And that creates, let's say, a whole set of interesting questions is how could the user understand the privacy characteristic of that authenticator? And you might have seen there's a lot of these counterfeit products, which is kind of a similar problem, right? I have a nice Rolex. How could I determine as a user whether this is the original or not, right? If the price is $29 and I'm buying that thing in Hong Kong, maybe that's not the original, right? It's a clear indication. But if the price is maybe $15,000, it could be, and I can't tell, right? And the same is true for the ATMs, right? And we have seen all these cameras observing the pin pads and the card skimming devices, which are modifications on a sink which somehow acts as an authenticator. We have seen a lot of other counterfeit products where it's hard to tell what the original is or not, right? So the SD cards, original and counterfeit product here, or even IC on an IC level, right? How could you tell whether this is a fake iPhone you have or the original one? It's difficult, especially for the user. So the industry came up with some kind of seals, right? If you see that kind of nice hologram seal, it's supposed to be the original one, which ended up with a very interesting approach from attackers. They created nice-looking, right, very convincing products, I think, with cream, sometimes with Nivea, you found products which look more original than the original, and so people were convinced this is the real legitimate product. In the end, they couldn't, right? But back to our problem, how could the user determine whether this authenticator is trustworthy or not? So maybe the easiest thing is to make it the user's authenticator, right? Not to give something to the user and expect the user to provide his fingerprint to anything which is unknown to him, but say, if this is your personal device, you can come up with your own measures to understand whether you want to trust that device or not. And if this is your device, you will possess that for a long period of time, so it gains some kind of reputation for yourself, right? You keep using it for years and years, and after some time, you trust that device finally. And this is your authenticator, so yet let's make this authenticator the user's authenticator, and let's see how this changes the characteristics of the overall scheme. So the user's authenticator will then verify what you are or what you know, right? This biometric thing or the PIN entry. And then the authenticator itself is what you have, which is kind of nice characteristics. Now we have a two-factor solution already, right? Which is much more robust against a lot of attacks, and we will come to that. And whether these factors are considered independent or not is a whole different discussion, but there's some interesting indications, right, from the PSD2, there's some indication if that is TE-based, they considered independent, right? We get very similar guidance from NIST, the new 863, the version 3 of that, which is currently in the work. You can see it on GitHub. Interesting how they define that, and this is that they have rules when, let's say, an implementation is strong enough to be considered independent in a single device. Now let's look into the security aspects of that. So there is different characteristics, right? By making it the user's authenticator, this is unsupervised biometrics, right? This is completely different than what we have seen in the past, where some guard is watching you, right? If I'm using eGate, there's some person looking at me, whether I'm presenting my face or in, let's say, an image or a display in front of my face. So this is not the case here, right, in the mobile biometrics case. This is the unsupervised case. The device, let's say, cannot be assumed to be protected by an environment, right? If I'm back to my eGate example, right, this is very unlikely that a person can have access, unattended access to that eGate to manipulate the eGate, right? Because there's always some watchguard, some person looking at that and a video camera observing what's going on there. What I do with my smartphone is my personal decision, and if someone steals my smartphone, right, he can do whatever he wants, right? There's no one taking care of that thing, which is another aspect. So this device, the protection mechanism, has to be more self-contained, if you will. Then, of course, we want proven cryptographic algorithms, right? We do not want the homegrown ones. We have tried that for years. In the crypto space, we have learned that the only trustworthy cryptography is the ones which have been attacked for more than 30 years and where people have learned what are the weaknesses, what are the strengths, and how to implement those cryptographic methods securely. And this starts from random number generation and it ends with asymmetric cryptography. So there's a lot of different aspects we have to take here. Next thing is we want proven protection methods of that implementation. And we have learned what proven means over the time, right? We have a large industry on secure elements, right? The smart card ICs, how to protect those against all different kinds of attacks. And we want robust user verification methods. And what robust means is another good question, right? The false accept rate must be somehow good enough, right? Maybe the one in 10,000 case. The false reject rate is even more important for the convenience. So if this is, let's say, my fingerprint sensor says no to me all, let's say, every second time I try to use it, I will stop using it, right? If it's, let's say, very reliable and I typically get in, then I might trust it. And then there's the presentation attacks, and we will come to that and the role of that. And then, of course, if you look into that authenticator, there's a whole lot of complexity, right? It's just a simple concept, but in the end, what you have inside is the entire biometric system with all the attack vectors you have for biometric system, which really starts with the presentation attacks at the sensor side and the potential attacks on the reference data you might have. You might have side channel injection attacks and all these things, and you might want to override the final signal before it gets to the crypto, unlocking the key in the end. So there's a whole lot of attacks you might see in that space, and you have to protect against to make sure that the implementation is more secure. And here's where it really gets interesting, because if you again look back into the IC world, in the smart card world, they have learned how to implement the cryptography very securely. They have typically not, let's say, been focused on biometrics. And likewise, the biometrics industry typically has focused a lot on all these false accept rate reduction and lately also the presentation attacks. But how to make this implementation secure, this has not yet been on the agenda, let's say, very often, right? You implement the software running in the rich operating system, not looking into other protection measures like the trusted execution environments and so on. So first thing here, what we really see is, if you look at that from an evaluation perspective, the target of evaluation must be big enough to cover all the things which have relevance for the security, which means other than the traditional IC, which typically covers only this thing, we have to cover the user verification starting from the sensor as well, because that's where the existing injection attacks like PIN phishing start. And then go from there and make sure that we shield the authenticator in the right way. And let's look into the two big classes of attacks and understand what that means. So the first attack class is a physical attacks. So someone has stolen your authenticator, has got hold of the device, and now can run a physical attack, take it in a lab, try to, let's say, open the ICs, open the sensor, try to create rubber fingers, and all those local attacks on that device. It's interesting, it can go into that, can have probes, right, inject signal, physical signals into that, whole lot of attack vectors. But it's a physical one, right? So stealing the device first is a requirement. And the second one, and I would argue the second one is more important in the days of the internet, because this is the one which really scales well, right? If you want to attack 140 million devices at the same time, right, you can't steal 140 million devices at the same time, right? That's impossible. That's too expensive, right? It doesn't make sense from an economic perspective for the attacker, right? So the scalable attacks to make much more sense for the attacker. It's just, oh yeah, sure, I have to invest maybe $1 million into an exploit framework, and I can do that. For example, I did that when stealing all these billion, not me personally, but people have done that for stealing the billion passwords from servers, right? That's not for free, but it's just the sheer number of the passwords they get from that justifies the investment of $1 million. Which is interesting. So with malware, you can attack the cryptography, the authenticator locally on the device. You can break the system, and we have seen a lot of malware attacks in the past as well. So essentially, when attacking, you can either extract the key material, which allows you to impersonate the user even if the device is offline, which nowadays, right, doesn't really make a big difference, maybe not, because our devices are online all the time. And the second is misusing the key material, which is even, let's say, worse or easier to do from an attack perspective, right? Even if you have a smart card and I see and there's no way for me to get the key out of that smart card, I could still, if I know the PIN, right, have malware running on that system, I could just misuse that thing, right? And go from there. So this is, a lot of attacks people have overlooked in the past, right, where they said, okay, we lock it down, we make it a secure element, and now we are secure. No, not really, right? We are secured against extraction attacks. We are not secured against misusing attacks. And this is where a smart card login, let's say, was attacked in the real world, where people just sneaked on some malware on the PC, right, intercepted the PIN, sent it to the smart card, used the open channel to the smart card to sign random hash values. They looked random, but in reality it was hash values they needed to get into all the different servers the PC was connected to. So secure element protects against the extraction attacks, but it does not protect against the misuse attacks. Very important to understand. And the second protection measure we have seen in the past was trusted execution environments. So something which is local on the device, it does not provide physical protection, but it provides some kind of logical protection. So different operating modes of that CPU, virtualization is one of that, Intel SGX is another one, Trust Zone from ARM CPUs is a third one. So there's a whole class of those. And they protect against this misuse attacks, right? The attacks, local attacks on that device with malware, but not the physical attacks. Now you could argue that a combination is the best thing you could have, and this is essentially what the industry is going after. It might take some time because there's a lot of, let's say, economic factors which get into that, right? Who owns the secure element? Who wants to pay for that? Who wants to get a toll if you want to use that, etc. But what we already have on most devices is TEEs. So there is a good starting point for us to use that security. And the third one, which I have omitted in the past, is there's a presentation attack still, right? If I have physical attack or logical attack, and this depends on the modality. If we are talking about speaker recognition, so the voice case, it's interesting. Most devices have a microphone, most devices have a loudspeaker, so I can just replay whatever voice I want to replay on that device remotely. So just a malware attack could be sufficient in that case. That's different in the facial case, right? Facial recognition, because the camera does not look into the display, right? There's no way that my smartphone's display can be observed by the smartphone camera, without a mirror in their room. So that's very unlikely to happen. Same with fingerprint sensors. So there are some differences. Largely, I would say presentation attacks are only relevant if the device is stolen, right? There are still a lot of stolen devices, so we have to look into that. So in the end, what does it give us, right? We have some authenticator concept here. We need some cryptographic material inside for doing the attestation, allowing the server to understand the security characteristics of that authenticator. We need some authentication keys to run the cryptographic challenge response protocol to make sure they are asymmetric, right? Use random keys, right? Make sure we get it right from the cryptographic perspective, and use all the proven technology we have invented over the last couple of years. Now, if we, let's say, step back a bit and look into that from a higher level perspective, we see that we have different classes of attacks in the end, right? There's the physical, there's the logical attacks, and if you look into that, we see, I would like to divide it in two classes. One is what I would call scalable attacks, which are attacks which are dominated by fixed cost, right? Where the number of targets does not have a material impact on the total cost of that attack. And the attacks where the number of targets have a material impact, which I would call the physical attacks. Now, when protecting against all this, remember my first slide where I said, okay, today we have the stolen passwords from the server. Second, we have the phishing attacks. And third, there are the other concerted attacks with men in the middle and so on. So, and I would argue that just by using the principles I've shown with the asymmetric cryptography and so on, we can protect against number one already. Right, there is no passwords anymore, which are sufficient to impersonate the user. Right, there might be a PIN-based authenticator, but if the attacker knows the PIN, it doesn't give it the ability to impersonate the user, because the PIN needs to be entered into the user's authenticator, and this entry process is observed and controlled by the authenticator itself. Right, it's the same with phishing attacks. Right, the users do not know their password anymore, or the private key anymore, right? The password is not relevant for impersonating the user. Next is stealing keys or passwords from server doesn't work anymore because it's only public keys, right? There's a strong cryptographic protection from deriving the private key or computing the private key back from the public key. And we can use channel binding technology for protecting against man in the middle attacks. So just by using that principle, regardless on the implementation security, we can protect against number one, which doesn't mean the attackers would stop, right? They will just refocus on different things. For example, number two, which is extracting key material, or number three is misusing key material on that device. And so we have to protect the implementation of that and find the right ways to make it hard for the attacker. And we can, let's say, grow that or add more protection over time, because the attackers will not be prepared today to extract all the key material or to misuse that key material. It will take some time for them to come up with new exploit frameworks, right, which gives us some in industry some time to add more protection measures to that thing. And if you compare that, right, what are the protection measures and how do they relate to these different threats, you see that number one can be addressed without TEs and secure elements, right? I said this is largely independent from the implementation security. It's just the principle you use for authentication that determines whether you can protect against number one, which is all the dominating attacks today, right? Number two and three and four, yeah, you need some kind of TE or secure element or a combination thereof, right? Especially four is misusing authenticated sessions, right, which is an interesting attack. So you might, if you look into that from PSD perspective, it's linking the transaction text, right, the transaction volume to that individual authentication event and display that to the user, right? This is how you protect against four. And then there's the class five and six, where the authenticators are stolen. Still 3% of the smartphones are stolen per year. So it's a significant number. We can't ignore that. But this is the latest step, right? If you do not start with number one, right, the attackers will just continue with number one, and a smart card itself, right, without the the trusted execution environments, the user interface, a secure user interface to it, won't solve that problem. And this is what we have done in the past, right? We have started here with number 5 and 6 with our IC world, and now we are kind of confused why still attacks can happen. Yeah, sure, we have not solved number 1, we have not solved number 2, and not solved number 3. So there is still ways to attack that system. Let's do the first step first, and then go to the next step, and then the last step, which is adding the physical security to that scheme. So that's very important. Now, after all that, what are new observations? What are the interesting new attacks we have seen? Very interesting. Kid Hero buys $250 in Pokemon swag with sleeping mums, right? Thumbprint. So what happened? Yeah, fingerprint, right? Does not really depend on me being awake. Right, while sleeping, my kids can come and present not my finger to the smartphone. No, they present the smartphone to my finger, and the effect is the same. Right, so it's authorized transaction. So if you want to think about how to protect against that, that's a nice thing. Right, that's the new attack vectors we will see. It's clearly a physical attack. Right, without physical access to my smartphone, it doesn't work. So it's, let's say, less concerning, but it's still an important thing to consider. Relevance of presentation attacks. There's some surveys on this topic. Sorry. So most people agree that the presentation attack relevance increases. So we have to do something about that, right? This is new and unsupervised biometrics. If no watch guard is there looking at you, that you are presenting your face in a live way as opposed to some image, iPad with an image on it, for example, then you have to think about presentation attacks and the protection against that thing. Last but not least, biometric data is not secret. So never forget that thing, right? This pose now with high definition video or high resolution images, that's great, right? You can derive the fingerprint from that thing. Case Computer Club has done that from some of the German ministers. Interesting. Right, very popular. It's a targeted attack, right? But we have to give the right answer, right? If you say I have to have physical access to my authenticator, that's the right answer to that attack, right? Because in that sense, I don't have to revoke my biometrics. I have to, let's say, revoke my authenticator, which I can do, right? And I still have to freshly apply my finger to my authenticator. And this is the presentation attack relevance, which gets into that. So that makes it so important not to overestimate the power of the biometrics, right? In the beginning, we somehow thought, okay, the fingerprint is kind of secret because it's so hard to get it. It's not, right? And it gets easier over time. And this is true for most biometrics, right? Even if you add temperature, right, infrared or near-infrared emissions from our body, that's not really secret, right? It's hard to observe. Maybe it's not yet possible to observe with existing consumer electronics technology. You might need more things, but it's not secret. So do not say it's secret, it's not. And the last piece, right, attackers are already focused on attacking devices. This is not a new observation. So we have seen the first, let's say, round of attackers which try to get malware on your device, and this depends a bit on the region where you are, whether malicious applications can be sneaked, side-loaded on smartphones, whether Play Stores have a relevance in your region, right? And they don't in China, they have in Europe largely, so that explains the difference, right? So the number of malware on smartphones is very low in European regions. It's very high or substantial in Chinese regions. Google has published interesting statistics on that. So very interesting to understand how the market dynamics work in different regions of the world. So, thank you.
thank you, Rolf, for the nice and interesting talks. I would like to invite any questions you may have that we can ask Rolf and leverage his expertise in the IT security.
Is this one? Sure. Give me a second. So you mentioned YubiKey. I think that so YubiKey has different products. They have a FIDO authenticator, which is a very interesting product, and this is maybe the example I take. An external USB token, which has a capacitive touch sensor. It doesn't have a fingerprint sensor, so it can only tell whether someone, which is a physical action, right, which malware cannot emulate, by the way, the physical action, whether someone touched that sensor. And this is used as a second factor, so you have a username password authentication as the first factor, right? A thing you know. And then you present that YubiKey FIDO authenticator as a second factor, for example, in GitHub and similar scenarios. And this authenticator runs essentially this protocol I described here. This is a FIDO protocol. That's existing for a couple of years now, gaining a lot of, attraction from the industry, 250 members in the FIDO Alliance looking at that. So the YubiKey has an attestation key. So the relying party can tell whether this is the original YubiKey or a counterfeit YubiKey. Very interesting here. It has authentication keys, one per relying party, one per site. So if I register my YubiKey to, let's say, the GitHub website, I get registered one key. If I register this to Facebook, right, they've recently introduced U2F support as well, and then it generates a second key pair. Those key pairs are not stored in the YubiKey itself, right? It's a dump device. It does not have persistent memory. It has a single key, which is a wrapping key, a symmetric wrapping key, and it sends off the encrypted, the wrapped private key as a key handle to the relying party, which is stored there at the relying party side. So the key handle, the wrapped private key in there, and some other information is stored there. After me entering my username and password to Facebook, for example, Facebook will send me a list of key handles I might have registered with Facebook back, and then my browser, web browser, will send all these key handles to all the authenticators which are attached to my device. And some of the key handle will be recognized by one of the authenticators, right? Because if unwrapping works, it can see, now the unwrapping works. I can, let's say, look at some markers in the key handle, the raw key handle. After unwrapping that, I can use the private key to sign the response after the user has touched the physical button, and then present or generate the response here, send it back to the server, and the server will verify that. And the driver of that was Google. When joining FIDO Alliance, they were working, let's say, on protecting against phishing. Right? They were subject to phishing attacks by state actors. So you might have heard about that a couple of years ago. So they said, okay, what can we do for our internal employees and now for our customers to protect themselves against those kind of phishing attacks? Okay, we introduce the smart card for the internet world, is how they call it, the U2F authenticator, FIDO authentication method. So it's really stripped down to the fundamentals, the small things you need from the cryptographic and security perspective, and make sure it's easily used, right? It works as a human interface device from a USB perspective, so you do not have to install drivers, right? No smart card reader nightmare, no smart card, a crypto API driver nightmare, etc. It's just inserting that device in your computer. It will light up, and then you touch that sensor, and you're in. very interesting perspective, but it's used as a second factor, right? Whereas other approaches say, in the smart card world, smartphone world, we do not really want a second factor, right, to carry with us, right? I have one hand to hold my smartphone. I have another to work on my smartphone, to touch all the different items, but I don't have a third hand to hold my YubiKey, even if it's NFC enabled, right? This might not be the right approach. So we are looking essentially, if you look from market numbers, we are not looking for only the 3% security conscious users, which we are looking at the 97%, which are more focused on the convenience and still want more security. And this is, for example, what NTT Docomo has rolled out in Japan and Bank of America has rolled out in worldwide for their customers. This is you use your smartphone with the authenticator capabilities the smartphone has, right, which might be the fingerprint sensor as a part of the authenticator. It's not the entire thing. And then say, okay, now the user presents a fingerprint, no need to enter a password anymore, much more convenient. You can even do that while hopping on a bus, for example, and so very convenient and strong authentication. And the interesting aspect is that the modality determines the convenience, right, whereas the implementation of the protocol and the implementation of the authenticator determines the security. So largely we can decouple convenience from security, which also gives us very interesting characteristics. So no trade-off between security and convenience anymore. Okay, hope that answers the question. Thanks. Yes, so the fundamental principle, the principles are exactly the same. The difference is that U2F always requires the relying party to send out the list of key handles which are relevant for that user. So you need to know what user it is beforehand, right? Whereas in UAF, you don't need that. You can just say, oh, device, here's a random number, the authenticator, here's a random number, please compute the authentication response and give it back to me. And when I see the authentication response, I see a key ID inside, and from there I look into my local database in the relying party side, for example in Docomo, and say, okay, this is user John Doe, right? So that's a fundamental difference. The UAF authenticator inherently is a two-factor solution, whereas a U2F authenticator is a single factor, which is typically used in conjunction with a username password to make it a two-factor solution. Yes, but it could be more, right? So this is always the question. I have a very, let's say, smart phone, and why couldn't I use this as a two-factor solution by itself? Why is it only, let's say, good enough for the second factor, and why is it so inconvenient to send all these, let's say, one-time passwords which do not protect against man-in-the-middle attacks and so on? So you can make it much better by using UAF, for example, to make the smartphone the sole factor, right? It's a two-factor solution by nature, but it's a single device you have to hold, which verifies you in the first place, and then has the access to the key to run the standardized authentication protocol. So it's essentially the use case determines that thing, right? Okay, more questions?
Do you think we'll have passwords in 10 years?
Pardon?
Do you think we'll use passwords in 10 years?
Very good question. So, to be honest, I think yes, we will.
50?
But I hope, let's say, that the security dependency is much less, right? That we do not depend so much on a password. Today, if we look at existing account recovery schemes, for example, they always send us a one-time passcode to an email account, right? How do I authenticate to my email server? Username password, right? So the weakest link today is really the username password, and I hope we can get away and can have more secure solutions, but we need to understand how we can deal with account recovery scenarios. In FIDO we say now you should register multiple authenticators. In reality, yeah, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. In Europe, we have a big advantage with eIDAS. I don't know whether you know what eIDAS means. So that's a standard where all European countries can announce their national identification scheme, right? Their national ID cards, which have are electronically enabled for identification in a interoperable way. And so in Europe, we could use eIDAS for doing the identity binding before registering FIDO authenticators, and use eIDAS as well for doing account recovery. So in Germany, I have a nice national ID card, right? It's NFC enabled. I could tap that to my smartphone in theory, right? It's not very convenient, and I'm not expecting to use my ID card, let's say, for daily banking purposes, because I don't have to do it today. But I could do that for recovering my banking account once I have lost my last authenticator, right? For example, my smartphone, and say, now, okay, now I do that thing once. I register my authenticator on the new smartphone, and from there on, I go and just have to do the FIDO authentication to my bank account, and can keep my ID card, electronic ID card, in my pocket for that time until the next recovery is required. So I think that, but this is a regional thing, right? Identification is inherently regional, so that's a reason why those things do not work on a global scale. So in the end, we have to work out the regional account recovery recovery scenarios, which is, in my opinion, the last piece which is missing to get into a password-free world. Good question. Thanks.
Thank you, Rolf. I think any further questions that we may have, we can use the panel discussion document that has been given in the welcome kit we have. There is a page called Mind the Gap. You may enter your questions there, and which will be taken up in the later session when we have the panel discussion. And then you would have another chance to talk to Rolf. And apart from that, we also have long coffee breaks and lunch breaks where you can catch up with Rolf and ask further questions. With this, I would like to thank Rolf for his interesting talk. With this, I would like to now invite Professor Javier. Key things about Professor Javier is that he's been an expert in biometrics for a very long period, and he has specialized in signature biometrics. The other key aspect is that they have been very successful in commercializing the signature verification to the bank applications. Based on this, he would be giving a talk on online verification of signatures. Welcome, Dr. Javier.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Kieran. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me here. Also, Professor Bush and his team. I'm happy to be here, and I will present some results we have in online signature verification. I come from our Vida Lab in Madrid, in Spain. We are doing biometrics for a long period. And we are mostly focused on behavioral biometrics, speech and keystroking, and also handwriting in general. It could be, some of you may think that signature is an old-fashioned way of authentication, okay? I will surely show you that it is no longer this, because because even if it has been used as a way of authenticating people in documents, in legal documents, in agreements, in transactions, the basic fact it is that it is a very well socially accepted modality. Okay, we don't have specific reluctancy to sign or to authenticate ourselves. And nowadays, the vast majority of commercial handheld devices, mobile devices, they do have handwriting recognition capabilities. So we have it. We have the devices, and we have the capabilities. So we can still use handwriting, and we do use handwriting. It can coexist with traditional means because we can use old documents together with new signed documents. Okay, we can also use in-air trajectories because the majority of the devices, they are sensible to in-air trajectories, and this is very nice because this is completely secret. Okay, there is no a physical trait on the screen or on the paper that you are doing this kind of trajectories. And also, it is worth to mention that it is handwriting modalities easily meets the privacy rule, for which the objective of the identification and the means employed are proportional. In many cases, we are thinking about means very, very high in the security range to do actions which are just familiar or those type of actions. Okay, and we have many attractive platforms for signature verification schemes. You may see here some tablets, phablets, mobile devices, two-in-one laptops, specific pens with video cameras and things like that. So we have all these kinds of attractive platforms to accomplish this kind of authentication. You may note that it is a behavioral trait. Okay? Behavioral means that it is not physiological. We don't have it. We cannot show like this. We have to make an action. Okay? We have to take a stylus and write. We have to speak. Okay? But this is something which is familiar to us. Very young kids, they do take a pen, a pencil, and used to write. It is familiar to us. So it is something which comes with our way of expression of communication. So it is not only that it is socially accepted, but it is a way that we communicate, okay, with handwriting, with signature. Okay? The thing is that being behavioral, we have a relatively large intra-user variability, relatively, okay? Signatures are not always the same. You have certain variability. And you could have small intra-user variability. Someone can forge your signature, and that could be very similar. We don't know exactly to what extent, because it depends on the situation, on the scenario, and so on. But it could be small variability. So we have to cope with this. This is our these are the limits of in general behavioral biometrics. And we have some general challenges. Aging is a general challenge in biometrics. We have to cope with that. I will show you some experiments on that issue. Ergonomy, of course, if we are, it is a handheld device, we have to cope with ergonomy. Interoperability, which is also an issue. I also mentioned the mimicking problem, the forgeries problem here. The signature sample itself, it is quite a low amount of data. You have data scarcity in the sample itself, and we also have a problem with handwriting, but specifically with signature, we don't have access to huge data collections. Huge here means tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of signers. Okay, we do have access to hundreds, to some thousands of users. But not access to, like in other modalities in which we have used, access to big data in general. Specifically, in handheld devices, we have some acquisition challenges, like lack of space, ergonomics, I said. Sampling quality is also an issue. for specifically for mobile devices and smartphones in precisely. The lack of pressure could be also a problem, and orientation, the lack of inner trajectories, and the possible use not only of a stylus but also the use of a finger itself. So we have to cope with this very specific challenges in signature verification. There are two main approaches: the offline or static approach. I will not focus on that, though that is a paper-based approach. That could be a little bit old-fashioned, and I will focus on online or dynamic signature authentication, in which you have access to all the time series that the device is giving you, basically the X and Y with time, and in the majority of the cases also the pressure with time. And from that basic information, which is an instantaneous information, you can derive many other time functions. Okay. Of course, scenarios in which you can apply this technology, of course, for user activation and login, absolutely. My smartphone, many smartphones, they do have these for activation. Payments, points of sale, we do still sign in paper, but we could sign on screen in many cases. Of course, for legal transactions, legal documents, e-government applications, we have an application in our university for doing this for the students, client validation, parcel delivery, or secure access to financial, medical information, or decryption and encryption of data. Okay, I will go into the details of the authentication process. These are the basic stages of the authentication process, in which you have the input sample, some pre-processing, I will go on that, then feature extraction, then you have the similarity computation, similarity checking, in which you have to compare to match with the already existing information, registration or enrolled information, score normalization, thresholding, decision, accept or reject. Okay, for pre-processing, specifically in mobile scenarios, you have to cope with several problems, like size normalization. You have to cope with that. Okay, you have to cope with the orientation of the signature and also centering it. You have to cope with that. You have to cope with the normalization of the input variables, specifically the pressure, if you have that, because devices, they have different dynamic ranges, so you have to normalize that. And in many cases, you have to resample, okay? Because if you want to adapt to several devices, you have to have a designed sampling frequency for that, and not the one that every and each device is giving you. So all these things must be done in order to pre-process the information, and so that all devices are common from the point of view of the input signals that they are giving you, and the feature extraction is accomplished in the same manner for all devices. Regarding feature extraction, what do we have in general? In general, we have X and Y with time, but in many cases, we have pressure with time. This is very interesting. Pressure is a very user-based information. So if we have it, or if you can decide to have it, because you can decide what devices to use, you should use this kind of devices. Orientation is not always a very nice variable, because sometimes it's a noisy information. But pressure, X, Y, and pressure, it's something you should use if you can. Of course, you can live without pressure. You can just live with X and Y information, because that's instantaneous information, and you can derive, as I will show you after, you can derive many kinematical and dynamic information from those specific time signals. Okay. From the point of view of feature extraction, there are two main approaches to the problem. One of them being the global feature approach. Okay. We have information, we have signing information, and we extract features to form a holistic vector, okay? A vector which components, from a holistic point of view, take care of what's going on into the signing process. For instance, how many pen ups and pen downs you are doing, what's the duration of the signature, what's the average speed, average acceleration. Those are global information in which you may form a vector and you can go into similarity computation, classical similarity vector matching. Okay. Our point of view is more focused on local features. Why? Because you have a very rich information. When you have X, Y, and hopefully pressure with time, you have a very rich information. So you can look into the details and you can extract many local information. I will show you afterwards. This is an example, okay, of a 40-dimension vector from the holistic point of view, from the global point of view. Okay, you can also go into selection feature algorithms, okay, in order to cope with the problem of very long vectors, which is the more relevant information, and so on. Okay, and that's a more classical approach to the problem. Okay, till the 2005 and so on, this has been the basic approach to the problem. Okay. But from that date to nowadays, we are using the local features. Okay. Why? Because you have much more precise information about what's going on in the signing, in the handwriting process. Because you have spatial features, XY coordinates, XY offset in two consecutive points, for instance, the sine, the cosine, information, the curvature, and so on, the radius of the in between two samples, and so on. But you have also the dynamic information, okay? The instantaneous speed series, instantaneous acceleration, normal acceleration, and so on. You have the pressure, you have the pen tilt, and you can do many things with this set of time series. Here there is an example of a signature, the time series that the device is giving you, XY pressure, and then the two angles with respect to the signing plane. Okay, and these are, for instance, a set of 18 complete time series we are deriving from that specific device information. Okay. Those are not numbers. Those are time series, complete ones. So it is a very rich information from the point of view of the custom information that the user is giving you. Also, first time derivative and second order derivative is very rich in terms of information because it gives you the speed and acceleration of change of each time series. So we include that also in our time series set. Okay, in terms of similarity computations, similarity matching, for the global approach, you have holistic vectors and you basically use distance computation, okay? Euclidean distance, Mahalanobis distance, whatever kind of distance approach that you could, in which you can match holistic vectors. But if you go to the dynamic or local information, you can use different approaches to the problem. For instance, here, dynamic time warping, it's a well-known matching scheme in which there is a point-to-point correspondence, and it is elastic. It means that you can set a kind of elasticity between the point-to-point matching. So if you have only 2, 3, 4 samples in registration, this is a basic algorithm that gives you very, very good results when using this time series. But of course, if you can have more information, if you can have more samples, okay, more signature samples, and in some applications you do have more, you should go to a statistical modeling of the data. For instance, hidden Markov models are a very good approach to these problems, to this problem, but you can use, of course, other techniques to do that. We are using these two basic technologies when you have less examples of the signature. You can just use DTW. When you have more than, let's say 6, 7, 8 examples, you can also use HMMs and then fuse information to have good results. Of course, we have taken a look to writing generation models. Professor Plamondon in Canada is a pioneer in these works, but we have also worked with him. Also, Mata, who's here in the group of Christoph Busch, has worked with us previously also in this problem. And, of course, you have access to the motor control system and to the neuromuscular response system in order to synthesize, okay, and also to improve your system performance. This is a very nice approach with signal log normal models in which it has been demonstrated that these models are very near to the actual way in which we do produce handwriting information. For instance, here you have several examples of signature. About 50% of them are synthesized, are not real, but I mean not synthesized from an example, synthesized from nothing, okay? And it would be difficult for us to say which one are the good ones. Okay, and you can take a look. I will show you which ones are the real ones and which one are the synthesized, and you will find some perplexity in the sense that some of the synthesized ones are very good ones. You see here with the crosses, those with the crosses are synthesized examples of signature. Using this sigma log normal model, which is very near to the, as I said, to the real information. Okay. Let me go into some evaluation. Where are we today? What is the state of the art in signature authentication? What are the problems? How are we coping with them? And what are the results we are finding inside that? We have worked in the last 3 years with SICABank, which is an association, a banking association, with more than about 50% of the global Spanish banks, okay, like CaixaBank and Bankia and some other banks. They are very much concerned on handwriting authentication because of the paperless office scenario, one, and because they want to authenticate users specifically when they go physically to branches and so on. That is the situation now, but of course we are working in the mobile, also in the mobile remote scenario. They had, for a quite basic system in which the user registered with 5 signatures in the same session, we use DTW and we use the BioSecure DB. Okay, we didn't have data, signature data. We used the BioSecureDB, which is a well-known European database you can have access to, with hundreds of users. Okay, hundreds. With less interoperability problem and with a limited time span between sessions, something like some weeks or 1 or 2, 3 months at a maximum. Okay, they had initial results with random forgeries, zero effort. Okay, zero effort matching of 6.9% EER. And we recently, in November 2016, we reached a 0.6% equal error rate for zero effort case. Okay, with more than 300 users and more than 10,000 signature examples. Okay, with only 5 signatures for registration. But we have also skilled forgeries in that case. We take from 13.7 to 4.9 the equal error rate for skilled forgeries. What does this mean? That at least in 95% of the cases, we are able to detect that a signature is being falsificated, is being mimicked in some cases. You have to see it this way. We are able to detect previously at least 95% of this mimicking, of these forgeries, which is very relevant. It is a very nice filter to the system and to the problem. Okay, but let's go into more difficult cases in which we have aging problem, in which we have interoperability problem. What do we have here? The case of aging problem. Okay, here we have the template aging effect with a configuration in which we are using signatures of the first session and we are matching against signature after 3, 6, 9 months. What do we have? Here you have, with only 4 signatures, you have a degradation from 0.6 to 2.8 equal error rate for zero effort matching. And from 4 point something to 11.7 skill forgeries. What can we do in that cases? We have to retrain the system. Okay, we have to ask the user every once a year, once every 6 months, to give us just one more example. Okay, one or two examples. And that could be the case for all aging problem in other modalities, in which the user, if he or she is using the system for long periods of years, has to register every some months, okay? Or you can use the information that is given you in some matching cases to retrain the system. If you do that, if you go to 16 signatures, 31 signatures, 41 signatures in your registration, then this problem could be completely solved and completely cope with. In fact, if we have 40 signatures, and in the second case we do have that, because in that case those are users or clients of the bank, we have time spans of some years of usage for each user. So you can have even a very reduced zero effort matching score of 0.1% or 0.7 for skill forgeries. We are working in new scenarios with the eBioSign dataset, in which we have actual real device interoperability and we have the finger as a writing tool. Okay, what do we have in those cases? I won't go into the details, but if you have these 5 devices, You may see here the same signer with the stylus, okay, and with the finger. What do you see? Basically, it is a smooth sample. You don't have the precision that you have with the stylus, so it is a smooth version of the stylus one. Okay, for if you just train the system with the first session, what do you have if you have five different devices and you want to compare from the interoperable point of view? What do you have here? You have the matrix, confusion matrix, equal error rates for all five devices against all five devices. Okay? What do you see there? You see that the EERs are growing, of course, but not in all cases. If devices are of good quality, even if those are different devices, results are quite moderate in terms of increasing of the EER. Of course, if the quality is low, the situation would be worse. But in the case the devices that are of good quality, in terms of acquisition quality, you will have good results. What do we have when we sign with the finger? Okay, and we just train with the first session. Here, you may see that with the finger. This is also finger. This D. So this is also finger. You can have very good results. Of course, if you go to a mobile device, to a smartphone, you can go from 1 point something to 4 point something in a real small in a smartphone. But the situation is also that here, what we see is that for the forgery problem, the finger is helping us, okay? The forger is less able to mimic when he's using his own finger. So the situation is that with the finger, we have an increase of the equal error rate of zero effort, but also a decrease of the forgery equal error rate. So that's good in terms of balance between the two situations. And we have worked also in other handwriting approaches, like using doodles, okay, with your finger. Here you have some examples. The problem with doodles is that forgers could be very good, if you know that. The thing is that we are supposing that you know that. Not only that, we are reproducing on the screen how do you do that from the dynamic point of view. So we are trying to shoot ourselves in order to be in the worst possible scenario in terms of forgeries. Okay? In this case, what do we have? Well, we have with doodles, we have nice results, but not as good as you have with, of course, with signature. Okay? You have a little bit more error. Just to conclude, we have still room for improvement in terms of algorithmic matching approach to the problem, okay? And there are many new areas of interest, new application scenarios, the problem of interoperability, the mixed writing tool, stylus, finger, and so on, and other possible. Of course, we have still room for improvement in the synthetic sample generation, and also in terms of evaluation and complexity evaluation, and also in terms of data and privacy protection. And that's all. You have some, okay, well, these are some algorithmic work we are doing nowadays with deep neural networks, and also with some modifications of the traditional DTW algorithms. We are working on that. And if you need some further reading, those are some of the works I can recommend you. And that's it. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Javier. In the view of short time that we have for the break, I would recommend that everybody